Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Turkish military incursion into Syria and assess its significance in terms of whether this will mean a more active role for Turkey on the ground in Syria, or will the impasse persist between the US and Turkey as Turkey's President Erdogan repeatedly insists that the priority should be to remove the Assad regime rather than face up to the consequences of earlier Saudi and Turkish support for the Islamic State and other radical factions who hijacked the Syrian revolution and have created havoc across the region. Henri Baki, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, who served on the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff and is the author of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, joins us to discuss the possibility of Turkey continuing to stay on the sidelines of a crisis they helped create. Then we'll look into another standoff, this time between Greece and Germany, where two very different personalities, one a leftist former economics professor and the other a conservative former tax collector who is an ardent supporter of austerity, are negotiating a restructuring of the Greek bailout in very tense talks that are not being helped by the Greek press characterizing Wolfgang Schäuble as a Nazi, and the German press criticizing the flamboyant Yanis Varoufakis as an uncouth hyperbolic Greek. The founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies, Theophanes Stavrou, a professor of history and classical and Near East studies at the University of Minnesota, and the author of Greece Prepares for the 21st Century, joins us to discuss how the clash of personalities is exacerbating policy differences as the Greek debt negotiations come to the crunch. Then finally, we'll examine the role of ISIS and other foreign actors in the chaotic Libyan civil war, which is hampering efforts of the various Libyan factions to come together and settle their differences. Mohamed Bamier, a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh and the author of Islam and Society, Social Movements, Global Structures, Social Critique, joins us to discuss what can be done to restart negotiations to end the factional violence that is bankrupting and destroying Libya. And joining us now is Henri Baki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And he has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Baki.
Thank you.
And the Turkish military incursion into the tomb of Suleiman Shah, where Turkish soldiers had been guarding this tomb, which is considered a part of Turkish territory in an agreement, I think, that goes back several decades. The significance of course, the tomb is that Suleiman Shah was the grandfather of the founder of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. So is there any significance beyond the fact that that Turkey sent some troops in to rescue these besieged troops guarding the shrine? Do you think it's likely to increase Turkey's involvement in Syria or perhaps provoke a backlash from the Islamic State in attacking Turkey?
No, I think this was an operation designed to bring the soldiers back who essentially were trapped in this location. I mean, this location was deep in Syrian territory. This is an agreement that the Turks made before even Turkey came really into existence with, not with Syria, but actually with the Mandate power, which was France at the time, that gave a certain location, a location to the Turks, where supposedly the grandfather of the Ottoman founder is buried. The irony, of course, is that that location was moved in the 1970s because the Syrians built a dam, and the dam created a lake, and the lake essentially overwhelmed the location. So the Turks and the Syrians agreed to move the location. But now, with the Syrian civil war, what happened was that those soldiers were effectively trapped, and it was. The Turks managed to a few times supply those troops with food and everything else they needed, but you had to go through ISIS control and make some kind of a deal with ISIS. But the situation in Syria is rapidly changing, and ISIS is becoming increasingly an unreliable, not that it was ever reliable, but the Turks always assume that the ISIS would not attack them. But I think there is an increasing perception in Turkey that ISIS is becoming very, very erratic, and you don't know when they might take action against Turkey or all the soldiers in that tomb. So I think the Turks decided it was prudent to pull those troops back. And in fact, what they did is they moved them to another location again inside Syria, just across the Turkish border, where it will be very easy to resupply them, because the Turks want very much to cling to a little sliver of Syrian territory as their own. No Turkish government wants to appear as it has given up on Turkish territory, even if it's no bigger than the backyards of a few houses put together. But this is where we stand. I don't think ISIS is necessarily going to react to this. In a way, it eliminates a point of friction between ISIS and Turkey.
Well, is there any significance to the fact that the Turkish column of tanks and armored personnel carriers and about 600 soldiers, 39 tanks, 57 armored personnel carriers went through the city of Kobani, which was just recaptured by Syrian Kurdish fighters who we all recall that the Turkish military sat on their hands while the Kurds were getting beaten, slaughtered by the Islamic State. The fact that they came through this town, is there anything?
We used to say politics makes strange bedfellows. War makes even stranger bedfellows. In fact, you're right. It's not that just the Turkish military stood by as the fighting between ISIS and the Kurds took place in Kobani. The Turkish president actually was very critical of the Kurds. He called them terrorists because they have some affiliation with the Kurdish insurgent group, the PKK. And the Turkish government was very upset that President Barack Obama decided to resupply the Kurds in Kobani against ISIS, and in fact helped the Kurds of Kobani defeat ISIS. And so the Turks are being in some way realistic now and realize that the Kurds are stronger today in Kobani than ever. They managed to survive and defeat ISIS. And if you are going to go in with such a large force, that was probably the only, given the road network in that part of Syria, that was a logical place to go through, and they had to make a deal with the Kurds. And this is very ironic. And in a way, it's going to blunt the Turkish government's rhetoric and arguments against helping Syrian Kurds fight ISIS, because the Syrian Kurds are continuing to fight ISIS. And it actually brings up a very interesting other issue, because there's this huge American Turkish base in southern Turkey that the Turks have refused access to. I mean, have prevented the American military to use to support essentially American operations against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. So is this going to lead to a rethinking, a reconsideration of that ban that the Turkish government has imposed on American use of the base? It remains to be seen, but I think the fact that the Turks used Kobani and Kurdish access or Kurdish routes or Kurdish permission to go through kind of takes away some of the arguments against the use of the American joint American Turkish base in Incirlik. And that I think is what's interesting, and we will watch in the next few weeks as this develops. Especially because, as you see from the press reports, that the United States is starting to think about the retaking of the city of Mosul from ISIS, wants the Iraqi forces and Kurdish forces in Iraq to do that. And in order to be able to do that, it needs to give those troops those the Iraqis and the Kurds air support, and it would be a great deal easier to do it from a base in Turkey rather than bases in the Persian Gulf. So this is the beginning of a change, and we'll see how it will play itself out.
Again, I'm speaking with Ori Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and is the author of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. It's a bit ironic, too, that in August of 2012, President Erdogan, then the prime minister, warned that an act against the tomb that the Turkish soldiers guarding the tomb of the grandfather of the founder of the Ottoman Empire, he said that an act against the tomb would be considered an attack on our territory as well as an attack on NATO land. And as you pointed out,
right.
There you have NATO land at Incirlik, and he won't let the NATO partners, particularly the United States, use the airfield. But doesn't this get back to what I was suggesting in the opening, Ori, that there is a standoff or an impasse between the U.S. and Turkey? Turkey's President Erdogan repeatedly insists that the priority should be to remove the Assad regime rather than face up to the consequences of earlier Saudi and Turkish support for the Islamic State and other radical factions who hijacked the Syrian revolution have created havoc across the region.
Well, yes, there is an impasse. You're right. I mean, let me just say one thing. The 2012 statement was not directed at ISIS at the time because ISIS did not exist. It was, I think, more directed at the Syrian government in case the Syrian government decided to do something with in revenge against the Turks. But it's interesting how Turkey, every time it feels threatened, immediately surrounds itself with the NATO shroud and the NATO protective shroud and wants NATO to intervene. And then when it comes to NATO operations, it's not always very easy to convince it to join. Mind you, look, there is a great deal of cooperation that goes on with Turkey and United States on a daily basis. I mean, we should also be mindful of that fact, including on the training of insurgents or moderate insurgents in Syria. But there is, as you said, there is a major disagreement between Turkey and the United States on who is the priority, number one. For the United States, the priority is ISIS, is the Islamic State. And for Turkey, it's always been Assad. And the Turks actually never supported the Islamic State. They supported another group called al-Nusra, which is also like ISIS, an outgrowth of al-Qaeda. I mean, the two are not that different from each other. And I think ISIS is more successful, ISIS is more violent, but al-Nusra and ISIS are both jihadist groups. And in a way, by supporting al-Nusra, you may have indirectly supported the creation and ISIS because so many of al-Nusra people moved over to ISIS. That's the issue. But for Turkey, I mean, they want Assad to go, and they think that if Assad goes, that somehow Syria is going to come back and become a whole again. And I think that's where Turkey is analytically wrong. I think Syria is so broken now that even if Assad were to be overthrown tomorrow, you are going to end up with chaos in Syria no matter what. So the American approach is, look, the more immediate danger to the security of the region is ISIS because it is threatening Iraq, which is far more important to the United States than Syria. And then, you know, through Syria and Iraq, it also threatens other countries in the region, especially Jordan. So the first order of battle should be the defeat of ISIS. And for that, the United States has increasingly been mobilizing forces, support, is trying to train the Iraqi army, which was blown to smithereens by ISIS last year, and, you know, retrain the Iraqi military and get the Iraqi military and the Kurds in northern Iraq to work together to take Mosul back. They have to take Mosul back, and that's very, very critical. If you're ever going to make Iraq whole again, the Iraqi central government has to take Mosul back. I'm a little bit surprised as to how quickly they think they will start the operations. I mean, if you believe in the papers today, they were talking about April of this year to start the operations against Mosul. I think it's going to be very, very tough to take Mosul back, but we'll see. But that's the priority. And here the United States and Turkey are on very opposite sides. And I think once the battle on Mosul is engaged, if the Turks do not pony up and open up the Incirlik air base to support the United States, you're going to see a major backlash, I think, here in the United States against Turkey, because if a pilot is downed, if we lose people and Incirlik, I'm sure they can use Incirlik for rescue operations, but remember, it's much, much, much harder to fly aircraft from the Gulf or from the Mediterranean Sea, when I say the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, to do operations in over Iraq and Syria than from Turkey. Turkish, the Incirlik base is huge, it's close, you can hover over your targets for longer, and I think it's going to not be good for Turkey and the United States if Turkey is seen to be preventing the use of that base when operations start in earnest. The atmosphere will change in the United States, you'll see.
Well, but there's been, in terms of earlier support for the radicals and al-Nusra, and as you say, many of them moved across to the Islamic State, which is certainly a newer phenomenon. But at least the Saudis seem to have recognized the extent to which Prince Bandar Sultan, the former defense minister, and the two Azeris, all of whom have been fired by the new king, the extent to which they, in effect, helped create ISIS, the Islamic State. Obviously, there's been a reckoning inside of Saudi Arabia. Is there any possibility of such a reckoning in Turkey? This Erdogan seems to be a very inflexible and egotistical man. Is he capable of recognizing the terrible mistakes that they've made?
Turkey is now engaged in a very divisive battle internally about the future of its political system. So it seems to me that under these circumstances, it's very hard for Erdogan to admit that he made a mistake. So I suspect that Turkey will not... And look, no country essentially says, I really made a mistake. And the Saudis never said they made a mistake. They just changed policy quietly. And that's a tacit acknowledgement of that they made a mistake. They didn't come out and say, we really blew it here. So I would say that even, the Turks, I think if they were to open up the Incirlik base to operations for the American Air Force, that would be a tacit acknowledgement that, it was a mistake what they did. But we'll see. But under the current circumstances in Turkey, where everything is so polarized between the two sides, between the opposition and the government and Erdogan, that I doubt very much that Erdogan will budge that easily. Further down the road, as Mosul becomes a really hotly contested area, and you see Iraqi forces and Kurdish forces fighting and suffering casualties, I think that's going to put pressure on the Turks. And they may actually do it very quietly. They may allow the United States to use the base and not make a big deal out of it. And that would be probably one possibility that may occur. I can't tell at this stage whether that's going to happen. But I think the Turks will come under pressure to change policies.
Well, Henri Bakya, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Henri Barker, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're about looking into another standoff, this time between Greece and Germany, where 2 very different personalities are butting heads in the negotiations over Greece's debt.
اكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي يواسيني
افتح مطافي لحظه في وجهي يا رسنيا γίνω το λαφανερά την αλήθεια να ζητάς να βρεις σε λάθος μόνο μάτια μόνο εαυτός μας φταίει κι η συνείδησή μας κλαίει αφού πέφτεις στην ίδια παγίδα ξανά για ακόμα μια φορά.
Κανένας δεν θέλει να μάθει την αλήθεια πως πόρεις μέσα και υλικό αλλάζει σε μια νύχτα.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Theofanis Stavrou, who is a professor of history and classical and Near Eastern studies at the University of Minnesota. His books include Redefining Southeastern Europe, Political Challenges and Economic Opportunities, and Greece Prepares for the 21st Century. He's also the founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Theofanis Stavrou.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And you're, as a historian, I'm sure you would agree, Theofanis, that personalities often dominate history more than policies. And is that going on in this standoff between Greece and Germany, where you have these 2 very different personalities, one a leftist former economics professor and the other a conservative former tax collector who's an ardent supporter of austerity? It does seem that these very tense talks are somewhat being negatively affected by this clash of personalities.
Well, there is no doubt that personalities do play a very important role in outcome, in historic outcomes. And this is really, in many respects, a historic moment, both for Greece and for the European Union and Germany. And one hopes that personalities will not get in the way. Unfortunately, we are dealing with strong people who are very much concerned with what the Greeks like to call philodemo, in other words, the love of pride or something that they do not want to sacrifice, even when they realize that they may be wrong in their behavior. And so my hope is really that having made their statements and having established that they are strong personalities, now they are going to take the next step that strong personalities require if they want to be viewed as charismatic leaders, that make the proper compromise in order to get themselves and their countries and their reputation out of a possible embarrassment.
Well, this is surely not being helped, though, by the Greek press characterizing the German negotiator, Wolfgang Schäuble, as a Nazi, and the German press criticizing the flamboyant Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, as an uncouth, hyperbolic Greek.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a German, after all, who said, and I'm referring to Otto von Bismarck, who said almost 100 years ago that sooner or later the bills for broken glasses by irresponsible press are going to have to be paid. So I think in both countries the press is really demonizing the other individual, and sometimes they are exaggerating, I think, because
both of them, I really reached the conclusion after listening to what they had to say and reading whatever has come my way, they are both desperate to have some kind of a solution. The question is, can they find the right words? Can they adapt, even temporarily, the right attitude so they can save face at home, in other words, to their own constituencies, and at the same time be of service to each other for outcome? That really is a trick, it seems to me. I am the first one to admit that I really was a little bit disappointed with the fairly bullish attitude of Varoufakis. He's an excellent economist, I believe, and people are admiring him for that. But I thought he, having taught abroad and having had the opportunity to work in situations where gentle language oftentimes has the last word, I thought that he did not have to be quite that aggressive in dealing with his European counterparts and lecturing them along the way as if they did not understand economics, not to say anything about politics. So I think he has a lot to learn. But this is also true of the Europeans. The Europeans seem to be resenting the fact that the upstart or a newcomer is telling them that they have done things wrong all along, and they better learn this time around. So it's a real standoff. You call it brinkmanship if you want to. But brinkmanship is a very interesting term, but you have something to fall back onto if you are willing to play brinkmanship. And I am not really sure that Greece really has that all much to fall back to if brinkmanship fails to work out in their favor. So I don't know. It's a very tough situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Theofanos Stavrou, who's a professor of history and classical and Near Eastern studies at the University of Minnesota. His books include Redefining Southeastern Europe, Political Challenges and Economic Opportunities, and Greece Prepares for the 21st Century. He's also the founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies. So in terms of these negotiations between the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, and the German finance, is he the finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble? I'm not sure that he's the...
I think it was the tax man.
He was their former tax collector, right. But I guess my question is, are these two just sort of, you know, obviously very different personalities? Are they just sitting in a room, you know, taking pot shots at each other, or is there some adult in the room who's sort of a neutral party that's trying to move things along?
The amazing thing is, out of all this, really, it seems that Mr. Tsipras, who was the one that everybody thought was going to be coming out with the most outlandish statement, he is behaving probably the most statesmanlike person of the whole group. In other words, he's quiet, he doesn't say much. He seems to want to reach some kind of a compromise. On the one hand, he tells the Greeks that we won a battle, but we did not win the war, as if that they're going to modify the austerity plan a little bit. But by and large, he is really being, at least I have been impressed by his attitude, even though he's not definitely one of my choice in terms of politicians in Greece, but he has been much more reasonable, it seems to me, in the way he's facing the situation. Varoufakis is, of course, the front man. He comes with good credentials. He's enjoying a lot of international support by economists, by many first-rate economists, and I think this may have really gone a little bit too much to his head, that he is going to tell them that this is economically sound. And many people say that his suggestions are really economically sound. But as somebody said, if he would stop being just a good economist and he become a little bit better politician, this really might help him get his economic message across better instead of alienating people with his a rather defiant attitude, I must say. He may not even realize he's doing that. I mean, that's his personality. He challenges people. He always did as a teacher, even before he became an active politician. And there is some charm to that. But I think your point is absolutely important. Are they really challenging each other, trying to see who's going to blink first, or is there somebody there who lets them get it out of their system and ultimately is going to force them to come together and reach some kind of a compromise? I think the agreement on Friday evening, the way it came out of the Eurogroup anyway, it suggested that even though they both have to swallow bitter pills, they nevertheless were swallowing them. And let's see what he comes up with, the economist, over the weekend. Because, as you know, one of the requirements was that this weekend, Greece is going to have to come up with a series of measures and agreements and steps to move forward that will satisfy the Europeans if they are to honor the agreement of Friday. So it's not all really a done deal yet, but it has come pretty close to a deal, I think, because both the European Union, they do not want, I believe they really don't want Greece out of the Eurozone, despite what we hear, because the consequences will be serious for the Eurozone, for the European Union. It's going to be a costly process. Many other people are going to wonder who is going to default next. And I think they all realize that they have to rethink this whole European plan for the economic move forward or for bailing out when they need to. And let's not forget that there is some kind of a huge pan-European plan in mind, and they're working within this pan-European plan, and some people are finding wanting. So my hope is that the Europeans, who are supposedly a little bit more mature in this process of compromise, they will be able to convince their interlocutors that it's to the advantage of both of them to compromise.
Well, there's no question that that Yanis Varoufakis has a very flamboyant gift of eloquence. He described the EU's fiscal policies as fiscal waterboarding, and he apparently has angered Wolfgang Schäuble sufficiently that some German MPs have called for Mr. Varoufakis to be replaced. That's not likely to happen, but
Don't say that. Don't say that, because I say that, first of all, they do not call Mr. Varoufakis, he does not call himself an erratic Marxist for nothing. In other words, one of his approach is that instead of replacing capitalism, as he himself said in an article which was published in The Guardian, he believed and he tried to convince like-minded people that the important thing really is to see what is wrong within the existing capitalist system and really point them out until they are able to come up with better solutions. So I think in some respects, he has something to say as far as that goes. Now, the other statement that you mentioned, I myself believe that if he doesn't really soften his language, he may very well be the person who becomes the scapegoat in this thing if it fails. Because, as I said earlier, Tsipras is appearing more and more reasonable all the time. And if really comes to such an unfortunate crossroads, it's not the first time that we are going to see somebody who has been the most active spokesman or aggressive spokesman is the person to be sacrificed and maybe save some of his suggestions. That's one reason why I'm saying it would be wonderful if at this point Mr. Varoufakis somehow, and how that can take place overnight, I do not know, if, in other words, he's able to soften his speech in his dealings with the Europeans.
Well, you're almost suggesting a good cop, bad cop strategy between the finance minister, Minister Varoufakis, and the prime minister, Tsipras.
Yeah. And again, those terms nowadays, I'm very careful not to use them, you know, because even though we know the background of Mr. Tsipras, all these people really are using these terms without the convictions, I think, of the old meaning of the terms. But I think you are right that one will be the good cop and the other will be the bad cop. And the question is, who is going to be able to make the difference in talking with the Europeans, who, after all, whatever their faults, the fact does remain that they have made many mistakes, but they also are a little bit more experienced at this, and they control the big cards in their favor, as it were. So I think, remember now, the Europeans were very upset even when they were dealing with John F. Kennedy, because many of the Europeans who are older at the game, they thought that here is a young American president and he's going to tell us what to do. Well, it takes different ways to convince people that regardless of youth, we have some ideas. And more important than that, if we are going to talk about economics, more important than that, we are really dealing with the future of our country. And the Greek people, voting the way they did, indicated that they had reached a very, very difficult place in their existence. And in many respects, we have to recognize that as being a democratic expression. And if the European Union is a union that advances democratic ideas, we should not get all that upset when some people, either in Europe or in other parts of the world, express themselves democratically. Now, let me also summarize by saying this. I also happen to believe that the Greeks should pay their debts. I also believe that the Greeks are willing to do that. And I think what they are looking for now is a more reasonable program that will allow them, over a longer period of time, and the ability to utilize some of whatever they hope will be the surplus in their economic output, to go toward programs in Greece to help employment, to help with education, to do things like that, instead of all that money going to pay the interest on the money which they borrowed. So it's going to take a good deal of patience from the Europeans. It's going to take a good deal of patience of the bigger economic powers and a lot of humility on behalf of the Greeks, even though right now there are many people who say the Greeks are more going for them because there is quite a bit of international popular support for the stand which they took, even if for no other reason, because economically it makes sense, and most importantly, a good many people argue that in the final analysis it's a democratic expression of 11 million people.
Well, just in the last minute, do you think that the proposals, Greece's proposals to reform its tax system, where a lot of people don't pay taxes, and reform its civil service, is that going to, you think, break the logjam?
Well, I tell you, I think it will. And more importantly, I hope the Greeks do that. I mean, really, in the long run, that is the minimum, it seems to me. So I think that's going to be very crucial indeed.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Theofanis Stavrou.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Theofanis Stavrou, who's a professor of history and classical and Near Eastern studies at the University of Minnesota. His books include Redefining Southeastern Europe, Political Challenges and Economic Opportunities, and Greece Prepares for the 21st Century. He's also the founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the role of ISIS and other foreign actors in the chaotic Libyan civil war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mohamed Bamyeh, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh and the editor of International Sociology Review of Books. He is the author of a number of books, including Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civic Humanity. And his latest book is Islam and Society, Social Movements, Global Structures, Social Critique. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mohamed Bamyeh.
Thank you.
And you're in Berlin, where you're working on a study on the future of, well, what is exactly, what is
right
this?
Right now, actually, we're doing work that is unrelated to the uprisings. We're just putting together a report on the social sciences in the Arab world and how they function. And we look at them at the universities and research centers, as well as in the media. And we are interested in finding out if, and to what extent you do have what we call kind of scientific analysis of social phenomena outside of the universities and the public sphere. So that's so anyway, that is related to studying the uprising, but different.
Well, can you give us some a picture of this uprising? It's so difficult to cover what's happening in Libya. Obviously, it's become a political issue here domestically, with the Republicans keep talking about Benghazi, trying to make a scandal out of that. But it would seem to be the larger scandal is that, you know, the US and NATO got rid of Gaddafi, but then just sort of forgot about the place and let it fall into total anarchy.
Yeah, well, that's it's not clear what they could have done. I mean, they may have kind of tried to keep the factions together for a while. But a lot of what is happening in Libya right now is actually being aggravated by outside intervention. And that takes the form of supporting a kind of some governments supporting some factions, other governments supporting other factions. And you can see the Emirates, United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Qatar, Algeria, Egypt, all of them kind of supporting one faction versus another within Libya. And this external kind of support dynamic kind of is causing the Libyan crisis to become even a deeper crisis. Right? Because the different factions within Libya are less kind of committed to dialogue with each other if they see kind of that they could somehow, or they have the illusion that they could somehow have military kind of decision on their side based on someone else supporting them.
So in terms of the countries that you mentioned that are supporting various factions in Libya, you didn't mention the Islamic State, because Egypt has been bombing them lately, and they made their presence known by the very graphic execution of a group of Coptic Christian workers by the sea. And the video finishes up with the sea turning blood red, and the camera pans up across the Mediterranean, and they talk about going to Rome and getting going after the people of the cross, etc. So obviously it's provocative, but
it's provocative. ISIS is a new factor in the equation, and of a very different type than all the other states. And what it is doing is working. It intends to provoke. That's what it does, on purpose. And knowing full well that the response to the provocation is something that is ineffective, ultimately. Namely, some the aggrieved country sends some more plane bombs at some locations and then goes home. But no government is willing to put soldiers on the ground to fight ISIS. So they know that this provocation leads to them appearing to their constituencies or potential recruits as fighting superpowers, right? Great powers, right? And surviving. Right? And then makes them even more appealing, right? To young recruits, potential recruits from around the world. So that provocation has roles. It's not just, purposeless violence. It is intended to actually kind of create a reaction, like the kind of reaction that you have that is haphazard, temporary, not part of a long-term strategy, but also contributes to ISIS appearing to be a kind of heroic, fighting all kind of the great powers in the world and surviving. And that kind of portrayal appeals to messianic kind of sensibilities in various countries. They talk about Rome, of course. That is part of the propaganda, ultimately, to make the group appear as a really world-scale kind of movement. Right? So there's a lot about ISIS, actually, that we need to be, we still need to understand really, much about how it evolved. But we can see that their use of the media is skillful. The violence, the extreme violence, seems to actually to be not far removed from the experiences of, perhaps a new generation coming of age in the age of online connectivity and not being actually faced by images like that.
Well, apparently there are 800 Islamic State fighters in Libya, and there's an extra 300 Libyans who've traveled to Syria to fight, and they've been returned. That doesn't seem like an awful lot. What are the kind of numbers of the various factions? There's the Libyan group. There's the group out of Tobruk. And you mentioned the foreign influence, the Emirates support, the Qatar support, those that are more associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. And I don't know who's supporting the Al-Qaeda affiliates.
Oh, no, they're supporting themselves.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, these are they're on their own businesses in Syria and Iraq. They captured oil fields, which they still hold in Syria. Particular and so the oil, the ransom payments, also a source of income, and so on. They seem to have fighters from around the world, right, who are typically young men, but also surprisingly some young women who volunteer for this, and who spend some time, right, in what they regard to be a global jihad in the territories of ISIS. And then many of them go back home. They're not necessarily always expected to stay. And that is when you... that is the next crisis that we are going to have later, right? Namely, what to do with all these hardened recruits who had this kind of experience that involves so much violence, right? Being redistributed throughout the world. They may be few in number, relatively speaking, but you don't need really that many to do the kind of graphic provocation that ISIS has become sort of specialized in.
And again, I'm speaking with Mohammed Bamyeh, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh and the editor of International Sociology Review of Books. He is the author of a number of books, including Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civic Humanity. And his latest book is Islam and Society, Social Movements, Global Structures, Social Critique. So when you talk about the Islamic State having basically self-funded through the oil fields that they've captured in Syria and Iraq, etc. But, compared to the main resource in Libya is oil, 90% of its budget comes from oil. and they're just simply not pumping much oil, and they're running out of money, aren't they? They can't. The various oil terminals and ports have been occupied by different militias, and the oil company, the national oil company, is just, you know, throwing up their hands. They're so frustrated that they can't, you know, and I guess the country must be burning through what reserves it has. So isn't that the real crisis?
Well, yeah, it is a big crisis, actually. And that is, I don't think it is unusual to have a crisis of this kind of gravity in revolutionary history. I mean, that's, it happens. The problem with Libya, ultimately, is that you have a political process that was kind of going forward to building a post-revolutionary state, and that process kind of broke down before it had reached kind of its destination. And so you have a situation where different factions kind of emerge. Again, that's not unusual. But the unusual thing was all of them had arms. And also, all of them very quickly found, without necessarily looking for them, external supporters in the shape of different kind of governments supporting different factions within Libya. So you have kind of external factors like the states, external states supporting different factions that causes to the dialogue to actually not go forward. Less incentive for it to go forward within Libya itself. But also we have a UN kind of a process of reconciliation that is also going on. And this is the one that we hear less about Libya, namely that there is kind of another political process that is going on. There is a mediator from the UN who every now and then is able to get kind of a different faction to talk to each other. So it's not as though it is war constantly in Libya, although that's what seemed to be happening today, but tomorrow we may have kind of a different process in motion.
So is this to do with the fact that the country's always been sort of divided and even under the dictatorship of Gaddafi that went on for a long time and obviously destroyed any kind of political institutions, and it was a rule of this insane egotist, but even he had to balance against different regional and tribal influences. Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And I think until Gaddafi, there was really no strong state tradition in Libya. I mean, there was the monarchy was not really a very kind of strong, modern, effective state, but it was there. And Gaddafi also did not kind of, when he inherited kind of that system, he developed the state into a form of dictatorship. But again, the state was something other than society. And what survived in Libya throughout that period was family relationships continued to be important, tribal relationships, local loyalties that continued to be important. So people remained connected with each other. And what you see now in these factions and militias in Libya is that most of them tend to be very local in character. So they are actually about protecting their own community. And they often do not fight far away from where they are, even though they may have allies somewhere else, like Houthi, for example. The Tripoli government has allies in Benghazi in the east, but it is not able to go support them because God knows that fighters coming from the west to the east will kind of cause too many instances of these people to flare up in the east. So it is a complex kind of society. It's an amalgam of societies. It doesn't mean that they don't talk to each other. It doesn't mean that there is no political process that is impossible. They did have elections before that was free and fair and worked very well. It can happen again. They had a parliament that was working for a while, and now it is not. Now they have two parliaments. But it's not as though they have not tried other kind of political processes. So it's not, I don't think it is kind of a foregone conclusion that Libya is necessarily going to break apart.
Well, but what would it take then? If it's already happened before, that the various factions will talk, will negotiate, and that the elections were free and fair, it would seem to me that it needs some kind of strong effort, some strong international effort to stop this. And you know, you say that the potential there is for a deal. Who's going to broker the deal?
Yeah, most likely at this point, the UN. There's a UN envoy can broker that. The more important factor kind of internally is when the different factions develop kind of mutual awareness that none of them has the ability to actually settle this militarily. And so far, that's the case. I mean, there's no one, clearly there's no one who is able to really win outright. Factions have been able to take some territory from each other, but all of them, in some way or another, are rooted somewhere in Libya, right? And they have a population, right? And constituencies, right? And means of support. Right? And they're not foreigners. Right? They're all Libyans, ultimately. Right? But each of them has enough local resources to make sure that they are not kind of completely defeated by the other. Right? Unless, I think, many civil wars end that way, right? When you have kind of a mutual exhaustion coming from within. Right? The different factions realize that there is no military solution anymore. And that is becoming apparent right now. And at that point, you have a political process that is promising.
Well, Mohamed Bamyeh, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And again, I'm speaking with Mohamed Bamyeh, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh and the editor of the International Sociology Review of Books. He is the author of a number of books, including Anarchy as Order, The History and Future of Civic Humanity. And his latest book is Islam and Society, Social Movements, Global Structures, Social Critique. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.